Hi, I'm Susie Burrell.
And I'm Leanne Ward.
And welcome to The Nutrition Couch, a weekly podcast from two of Australia's leading dietitians, bringing you everything that is new in the world of nutrition, diets, and good food. From The Nutrition Couch today, we take a closer look at chronic calorie deprivation. What is it, and could you be suffering from it? One of the listener areas we look at are greens powders. Are they actually beneficial, and should we spend our money on it when it comes to our nutrition? Our supermarket find of the week is a new high-protein braised bread, and our listener question is all about coconut oil. Is it really the fat burner it's claimed to be, and will it help with weight loss, and should we all really be using it? But to get us started, how are you going this week, Leanne? We've had a little change to our plans with the recent lockdowns, and we won't be seeing each other as soon as we hoped, but we may be coming together in the Sunshine State if things go to plan.
I know, I was supposed to come all the way to see you, going to get in my Blue Mountains hiking trip, Susie, and it looks like you'll be coming to Brisbane instead.
It's certainly a very challenging time, and we're really thinking of all the families who have had their holidays hijacked because of this terrible virus again. We're hoping that the Nutrition Couch can bring you a little bit of relief and you're still managing to get out in your hours activity each day, and we're definitely brainstorming a lot of new content for you in this time, and perhaps we might take a day or two in the Gold Coast together if we can to get some photos done and do some more brainstorming. But it's definitely a very challenging time, so we are thinking of you all out there. So to kick us off today, something that's been trending in the media and it really took my eye is an idea of chronic calorie deprivation. Now, this was a scientific term given to something that I would say I see quite often. And if I was putting it into layman's terms, I would say it's a situation that presents when I have a client who has been chronically restricting calories with the goal of controlling their weight for a long period of time. So we thought it would be a really opportune thing to discuss on the potty today, given that a lot of our listeners do actively work out, they're going to the gym a lot. A lot of your followers and your listeners, Leanna, are really committed to their training regimes. And I too see it with my clients who are going to the gym occasionally even, but they're really, really strict with their calories. So we thought, let's have a really good discussion around it. What is chronic calorie deprivation? What does it do to your body long term, and what are some signs you may have it? So tell us about your experience with this area in your practice.
I really do see it in a lot of my female clients, and they're the ones that are constantly dieting, and not necessarily the yo-yo dieters where they lose, you know, 5-10 kilos and they put it back on again, then they're on a next diet a few months later, then they put it back on again, they start a new diet a few months later. It's more so in really a lot of my active clients, Susie, who are what you would call a healthy body weight looking at them, but they just want to lose, say, like a couple of extra kilos or something like that. That's where I'm really seeing it in my clinic. So it's a lot of my very active females who I find are over-exercising and under-eating, and that's on a regular basis. So this can be, you know, over a 6-12 month period or even longer. And what I usually say to people, in terms of chronic calorie deprivation, yes, to lose body fat, we need to be in a calorie deficit, but we don't want to live in a calorie deficit. We cannot live in a calorie deficit because over time, our body adapts metabolically and starts to slow things down, starts to conserve energy. Some of our bodily processes over time and from consistent under-eating will actually start to down-regulate quite a lot. So I normally say some of the big, what I would call red flags to look out for if you've been under eating consistently is a real lack of energy, missing or irregular periods. If you're always sick or injured, if you're someone who gets injured, like you can't complete a 12-week training block without being injured, or you can't complete a 12-week training block without being sick, that's something to really take a look at. That's your body saying to you, hey, you're not either giving me enough rest or you're not giving me enough food. I also find things like always cold. Someone who's always cold generally will have a lower body fat percentage than other people. Any other red flags you can think of when it comes to consistently under eating? Because they're sort of the big ones that pop to my mind.
The two standout features to me that scream chronic calorie deprivation is when I have a client come in and they don't have a lot of weight to lose. Their goals are really body fat related. So they're absolutely in the healthy weight range, and say they might be 68 kilos, but they want to be 63 kilos and reduce their body fat. So they're not overweight by any means, but they're trying to lean up. And the standout thing is when they count their calories, and often they're trying to stick to 1,000, 1,200 calories. There's such a discrepancy between their basal metabolic rate and its needs. And I know you've done several of your own podcasts on that, which we can point to if people are interested. But then they may then go and do CrossFit or an extra run as well, get their steps right up to 10,000, 15,000. So at a conservative estimation, they're burning an extra 600-800 calories per day. So they're trying to eat 1,000-1,200 and there's a 600-800-1,000 calorie difference. So in their head, they're thinking, well, I should be losing weight because I'm exercising more and eating less and less or keeping my calories so tightly controlled, and yet nothing's happening. And that screams to me chronic calorie deprivation, because the body is in this stable pattern where nothing is happening. The stricter they are with their diet and the more they actively restrict physically and psychologically, so that they're actually overriding their body's natural signals to the point where they don't even feel hunger anymore, and yet they're burning a lot of calories. And without having a scientific reference for this, my estimation would be if the calorie difference is more than 400 calories, that is a sign that you're eating too little for the amount of activity you're doing. And again, anecdotally, sometimes I'll, just to see what's going on physiologically, and it's often girls, so I'll say with these girls, is that I'll get them to stop training or stop CrossFit or stop the really high intensity activity for a week. And even if I hold their calories at that 1200 point, often then they lose. And then I know when they do exercise, we need to basically eat more to give the muscles the fuel they need to actively burn carbohydrate and fat efficiently and allow their body to lose weight. But the big challenge I have is that even though in theory it makes sense, it's such a big shift to go from being so overly restricted with diet and so rigid with physical activity that it's a real, takes time, it takes several weeks, a lot of trust with the clinician for them to build confidence and allowing their calories to be increased when they're so used to sticking so strictly to those restricted calorie levels. And those numbers, very common, 1,000, 1,200 tend to be the default that this group go to.
Absolutely. And that's where we really want to reference our colleagues, you know, such as psychologists, where they can become really useful if you have a lot of fear or anxiety around deleting the calorie counting apps on your phone, around eating out, around actually increasing your calories or increasing your weight. Because often we say that sometimes you need to gain weight in order to restore those metabolic processes in order for you to actually lose weight long term. Because sometimes we've been in a calorie deficit for so long that we've got nowhere to go with that in terms of our body. Like, we can't decrease calories anymore. You're not losing weight at what you're doing. What you're doing is, like, you can't possibly exercise anymore. You can't possibly eat less. Where are you going to go from there? Of course, you have to reverse yourself out of that. And that's that concept of reverse dieting that we do here a little bit as well. So I would also say that with that sort of consistent under eating, there's a whole element of stress that goes into that as well. And what I really do find is within a lot of my ladies doing that high intensity type exercise, particularly first thing in the morning. If you are in a calorie deficit and a large one, as you said, over 300-400 calories, most people are trying to put themselves in deficits of, you know, 500-700 calories. If you're waking up at the crack of dawn, like 4:15 in the morning, you're going and you're doing high intensity exercise on an empty stomach, it's just a recipe for disaster. You're constantly stressing your body out when it's got very little reserves. And so if you're someone who is constantly getting sick or injured, you need to reassess what you're eating, reassess the type of training that you're doing. High intensity training is not good for stress levels. And I never, I'm not an exercise professional, but I never recommend my clients do it more than about 2 to 3 times a week, because it is just that added stress to the body that it doesn't really need. And particularly if it's first thing in the morning. So yeah, that's something that I really do see a lot of my women suffering with. They're just forcing themselves to get out of bed on very little sleep. They've got lack of energy from terrible amounts of calories and just that high intensity exercise. It's like a triple whammy altogether, and they're not getting results.
Particularly when that early morning training comes at the expense of sleep. So it's safe to say that females will need, or adults will need, at least 6 hours of sleep per night at a minimum to maintain optimal metabolic functioning. So if you're getting less sleep or poor quality sleep, plus then pushing yourself to get up exhausted and train, often fasted, and then have insufficient carbohydrate after the session to recover, it's all of these factors that contribute to this ongoing stress in the body. And so I would always say to my clients, rather sometimes than focus on, oh, I don't think you should train or stop training, because that's also got an element of addiction or love that they get something out of it. It's more, at least prioritize the sleep so you've got that as a base, and try and get to bed earlier if you do want to train at that really high intensity. And start when, if you suspect your calories have been really tightly controlled for a long period of time, you don't have to go from 1,000 or 1,200 straight up to 1,800 per day, because that's going to be really uncomfortable psychologically and also physically, as the body clings on to a lot of extra fluid with that carbohydrate on board. And you will see that increase in the scales, which can be really disconcerting. So what I would say is the key is to look at it as a longer term project and to gradually grade up and change things around so you don't find it more stressful than it is. So for example, I would say, right, prioritize sleep as a starting point. And then, as you said, focus on training a little bit less, maybe two or three times per week. Make sure you've got a little bit of carbohydrate on board, whether you've had some at dinner or some a little bit before training. And even just adding an extra 100 or 200 calories to that first couple of meals in the day. And signs you're on the right track with it will be suddenly you start to feel hungry again. You're not so obsessed with food all the time. Because the other observation I have, Leanne, with this group is that they restrict. And then they binge, because mm-hmm. the physiological drive to eat is so strong after a while, or psychologically the feeling is that they've been so good, so good, so good. And then all of a sudden it just all falls through and they binge and they go and have a massive weekend, and it repeats the cycle of guilt that fuels it. So it's about resetting the baseline slowly in a way that the girls are comfortable and so they can self-direct it, but really getting back in touch with our bodies and what our bodies need and what our bodies are telling us, rather than trying to stick to a strict calorie number on a piece of paper, on a calorie monitoring, or on a watch that's telling you exactly how many calories. But definitely if it's more than a 400 or 500 calorie discrepancy between what's going in and what's going out, that's a sign to me that people will be flatlining and nothing will be happening, and will absolutely explain why people aren't getting those weight loss results, or fat, specifically fat loss results, that they're looking for.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I would say that before clients come and work with me, 80% of the ladies that sign up to my coaching service, Link Up My Method, are that exact picture that you described, that early, you know, first thing in the morning, high intensity cardio, super low calories, super, super strict. And then they're binging later in the week or on the weekend, and they're just not getting that result because their body is constantly in the state of stress. And when we're stressed, we pump out cortisol, the fat storage hormone. We're doing the opposite of what we actually want to do for fat loss. So absolutely, I think we really describe that picture of that chronic calorie deprivation. And the sad thing is that we see it nearly every day in our clinics, don't we, Susie?
I see it all the time. And I think the other thing we have spoken about before is the power of change, because bodies get really used to training regimes. They get really used to dietary patterns. So again, if you're someone who's really heavily almost addicted to your high intensity training, or you'll run each day, but your body isn't changing the way you want it to, an easy thing to do is just shift your training around a little bit. And often that can be all that's required to get you back in touch. And you might walk a little bit more for a while, or you may do a longer session on the weekends when you're eating a little bit more and back off or reduce the amount of time you're spending doing that high intensity activity. So I think change one variable at a time. Make sure your baseline is strong and you're getting the minimum amount of calories and sleep. And as a rule of thumb, 1200 for most of our listeners will be on the low side. You probably need a baseline closer to 1400 at least, just to get started. And even those little tweaks, and a sign you're on the right track, is that you feel better, because we're often looking for outcome on the scales or feeling hungry, which are great. But I always ask my clients first, if you're feeling better, more energized, less fatigued, less obsessed with food, it's a sign you're on the right track. So getting a little bit back in touch with how you're feeling can be another good way to gauge whether you're on the right track with that.
Absolutely. And finally, to wrap us up, I'll just touch on the sleep thing again, just to bring that home, because it is so incredibly important. And I know you mentioned at least 6 hours, and that is the absolute bare minimum. I'm not talking new mums here. New mums do the absolute best you can. If you got 2 hours last night, you go, girlfriend, or new dads, you know, as well. But really, if sleep is something that is in your power to control, we absolutely should be prioritizing that first. Because I was reading a sports nutrition journal, something around psychology, and it was basically saying that athletes who get less than, I think it was 7.5 hours sleep a night, are 60% more likely to have an injury. I've read stories from, you know, the top tennis players in the world. I think Nadal was one of them. And he's saying he gets 9 to 10 hours sleep a night. And if he doesn't, he just does not perform. So the more sleep you get, the better your performance is going to be. So I would say for the majority of our listeners, we should be aiming for 7, 8, even 9 hours sleep a night, if that is in your power to control. And that's a really, really easy variable. Get off your screen, get off social media, get to bed bed that little bit earlier and you'll do the world of good in terms of your fat loss journey, but also in terms of injury, recovery, rest, illness, all that sort of thing as well.
Well, you'll wake up earlier again the next day and you're more likely to get hungry in the morning. So it's good for metabolic rate and our programming on circadian rhythm. But the other thing is, you know, exercise or high intensity training, as you've described, it's stress to the body, it's inflammation. So what we do know is that extended periods of rest and downtime help to reduce inflammation. But the one last point I wanted to make before we move on to our next section is that new mums, it is not the time to be putting any more pressure on yourself. So we strongly advise against any kind of dietary calorie deprivation when you've got a new child. So be very clear on that. We do not advise any kind of deprivation or calorie restriction when you're a new mum.
And our sleep guidelines of 7, 8, 9 hours are not for you.
Just do the best you can.
Definitely. So hopefully, listeners, these tips, I guess, help make you aware of this concept of chronic calorie deprivation. And we would really recommend working one-on-one with a professional because it is an area that is, you're kind of racked with guilt. You're unsure. You don't know what you're doing. You're like, I'm doing everything right. Why is nothing working? It really is that time to link in with a professional such as an accredited practicing dietitian or a sports dietitian to really get your health and your, I guess, your results and what you've been training hard for back on track. And I guess, Susie, that brings us to our clinic question of the week. What we're really seeing in clinic this week, I think this ties into the whole winter, it's cold, lockdown, COVID, that sort of thing. People are understanding that gut health is so closely linked to immunity. They've heard on the podcast before how important vegetables are. And I don't know about you, but in my clinic this week, a lot of clients are getting a lot of DMs through Instagram asking me about greens powders. People saying, look, I don't eat many veggies. I've heard you say how important they are. Can I take a greens powder? Is that a good option? And honestly, I see it all over social media. Every influencer and their dog is getting paid to promote a greens powder. But Susie, are greens powders actually good for us? Are they as good as the real deal?
You may correct me, but my understanding is that there is no evidence to support the use of powdered forms of vegetables to have anywhere near the health benefits of the fresh varieties. I've never used them. I don't recommend them. I'm acutely aware they're often based on, is it pyramid style programs where there's kickbacks for people recommending them? So it's definitely, as a dietitian, as a nutritionist, I'm sure you're very much the same. What we do know is it's the synergistic effect of the nutrients found in whole natural foods that give you these huge number of health benefits. And we can just never replace that, whether it's a greens powder, whether it's a multivitamin in a jar, it's just not the same thing. So the time it comes up for me is with children and parents thinking that the kids aren't great with their veggies, can they just throw some greens powder in to make them feel better? And I really want to stress, I don't advise it because the last thing I want my clients to do is spend $20 or $30 on a powder that I'm not sure is going to do anything really. And that's the truth of the matter when it comes to the science. And we are accredited practicing dietitians and we do need to always report the science, not what we believe to be true, but what the science shows to be true. And unfortunately, the science isn't there to back up these claims. So, you know, in terms of how do we get those key nutrients at this time of year, I think this comes to putting on our thinking caps about how do we find a form of vegetables or leafy greens or juices or soups that will pack that in. Now, as a rule of thumb, and I've just written an article about what dietitians do differently to the rest of the population when it comes to their own diets. And I would say that whenever I've been to a dietitian's conference, the salad and veggies go first. So we're having 2, 3, 4 serves every single meal. And that takes us to that 7 to 10 serves of fresh fruits and vegetables minimum a day that's associated with optimal health outcomes as shown in the Mediterranean diet. It's not about just ticking the box on 5 a day for optimal health. We really want to get up there at least sort of 10, if not more. And so the key, it doesn't have to be boiled broccoli or kale on a plate. You know, it doesn't matter whether you juice them, you make them into a soup, you make them into chips, you have them as salads, as long as you get them as a whole food in some way. And specifically with leafy greens, I'd be aiming for at least a couple of serve of those. And when we talk about leafy greens, they've got a specifically benefits associated with anti-cancer action in the cell. They're a really rich natural source of folate, which is much better absorbed than synthetic forms of folate that we consume in breads and cereals and in some types of supplement form. And for health, I'd be aiming for at least a couple of those, whether it's kale, broccoli, spinach, to get those huge number of health benefits. And you'll never see me recommending buying or even supporting, I guess, the use of greens powders for that reason.
And dark green leafy veggies, when paired with a source of vitamin C, such as tomatoes or a squeeze of lemon juice, are really high in iron as well. And we do know that there are a lot of our female listeners who are, you know, quite deficient in iron as well. So heaps of benefits for actually eating our veggies. And as you mentioned, there's just no research or science that supports the same benefits from eating veggies as you would take them in a powdered form. And what we do know from the research is that we simply just don't know how these powdered forms of supplements, or how these supplements and pills and powders interact in our body in that powdered form versus how they do in a whole food form. Because as you said, when it's in a whole food, you're not just getting a huge amount of vitamin C, you're getting folate, you're getting potassium, you're getting fiber, you're getting some carbohydrate in that vegetable as well. There's a whole lot of other nutrients, and they all act together to help that absorption process within the body, which we just can't kind of replicate that in a powdered form. So I'm sort of in two minds, Susie. I'm sort of in a look, if you don't really eat any at all and you've tried your best and you really can't get them in, maybe you've got some sort of food aversions, or you gag, or like you've got something going on, maybe taking a greens powder is better than a kick up the ass, right? But at the same time, we don't know really the safety of that long term. Not that I would think that that's unsafe long term, but we don't really know the benefit of that long term. So if you've got the money and you're happy to spend it, that's okay. But I really think that there's probably 50 other things that we can do beforehand to really try to get in our veggies in a whole food form. Because as you mentioned, it's not just the veggies itself, it's the fiber, it's the polyphenols, it's the antioxidants, it's the prebiotics in those vegetables that are so wonderful to our health. And noting that our taste buds do really change in about anywhere between 4 to 8 weeks' time. So if it's just a taste thing for you, and you're an adult, I mean, this is difficult if you've got a 3-year-old who's fussy, but if you're an adult, honestly, suck it up, keep eating them, and in a couple of weeks' time, they're going to taste a lot better than they did when you originally had them. I think for some of us, we try them once and we go, oh, I hate that, I'm never eating that again. And then we never really keep trying. You know, that's the thing. We know that with children, it can take up to, what's the research, Susie? Up to 18 exposures, 7 to 10 exposures. Yeah, I thought it was even higher than that, of the food before it even becomes familiar and sort of allowed on the kid's plate. So that's really with adults as well. You might have to have up to 10 exposures of vegetables before they even taste remotely neutral to you. And then maybe another 10 exposures before they actually start tasting okay, and things that you're able to add to food. So add lots of, you know, onion, garlic, flavors, seasoning, put them into smoothies and soups, as you mentioned, to start with. And the blander types are ones as well, like zucchini. I grate zucchini and put it in my porridge because it literally doesn't have a taste. So start with some of the blander types of vegetables and see how you go. And really, you know, throw in a whole heap of garlic and a bit of soy sauce and some, you know, garlic powder and that sort of thing to make it taste a lot better. Even drizzle them in extra virgin olive oil, tastes a hell of a lot better to start with, until your taste buds do adapt long term.
There's absolutely a general level of acceptance that has to come. There's certain things we have to do. We have to get up each day and brush our teeth. We have to put our shoes on. We have to put our underwear on, most of us. And it comes down, if health is your goal, you can't get around it. You have to try and eat some greens. And I was thinking a little bit back to the greens powders. My scientific brain's thinking that just that processing in itself to get a greens powder, whether it's a heat exposure, processing, chopping, grating, simmering down, concentrating, surely what we know around the anti-cancer molecules, they're very unstable. I don't think that they would survive that process. So I think it's safe to say that we're definitely not getting the dietary fiber and probably not the phytochemicals that we know are particularly powerful in keeping the cells healthy when they've been processed down to that concentrated powder form. Even though we're thinking it's concentrated, I'm thinking that just even that process would destroy a lot of that nutrition. But going back to ideas on the veggies, you know, I had a client who was very anti the veggies and had just not grown up on them and wasn't overly open. And, you know, one of the things we worked on was getting a juice mix that still had a sweetness to them, because one of the things about not liking fruit and vegetables or foods that aren't sweet, particularly with children, is that we're not programmed to like foods that aren't sweet. So if your palate is filled with carbohydrates and sweet fruit, for example, maybe sweet potato is a starchy veggie, but you really tend to stay away from things with a blander, stronger taste, things like the broccoli or the kale or spinach or even the zucchini, because it doesn't have a strong flavor. It is about reprogramming and getting used to having it in a certain way. And my mantra with clients has always been, I don't care how you eat those vegetables as long as you eat them. So even if it means having it in cheese sauce, if it means adding salt to them, the benefits that come from consuming that bulk of veggies and salad every day far exceed any of the negatives with a little bit of extra salt or a little bit of extra fat. Now, obviously, don't go gangbusters and, you know, put cream and what have you. But within a moderate approach, it's definitely better to be having them and make them taste good. And that's a good mantra for kids. If the food tastes good, the kids will eat it. So don't be scared about doing that. you know, another technique with children, and you can use it with adults, is we only need a couple. So you may only like grated zucchini or happy to have that, a green juice, and then you might like raw carrots. Well, we've got an orange one and we've got a couple of greens. We're on the right track. So don't feel like you have to have the whole spectrum to get the health benefits. Now, the spectrum's great if you can have it, but even just a couple of each type, whether it's raw, cooked in a soup, you're on your way. So aim small and build, but basically from a health perspective, our best tip, and I'm safe to say, would be just eat more vegetables. It's the line I give to more clients than any. Where are the vegetables every time they send a photo? Because it's half a third of what I would be prescribing for optimal health.
Couldn't agree more. Definitely. So get those veggies in, guys, any way you can. If you have to drown them in tomato sauce or add cheese on top for now, get them in as a starter, and your taste buds will grow and change over time, and we can back off some of those additions over time. But as Susie said, the benefits of eating veggies in any form far outweigh the benefits of not eating them at all.
100%. And we'd love, if you want to post any of your veggie rich meal ideas on ways to slip them in, we'd love to see them at the Nutrition Couch podcast on Instagram. We're seeing more and more of your messages and your recipes. We're loving it. So keep them coming. And if you want to focus on the veggies, we'd love to see them. But now we're going to move on to our product of the week, which is a very popular segment. And this week I wanted to take a look at, there's a growing range of protein breads in supermarkets, and specifically I wanted to look at the Woolworths Macro Linseed and Sunflower Low Carb Loaf. It's been around for a while now. I think looking back, the first lower carb loaf we had was the Herman Brothers, which is packaged for Aldi in supermarkets, and that product's been around for quite some time. But for people who don't shop at Aldi, it can be a little bit challenging to track it down, and now Woolies in their Macro Green range have brought out this higher protein, lower carbohydrate loaf. It retails for $5. It's a reasonably small loaf. It's got 11.6 grams of fiber per two slices. It's got a 5-star health rating. And per two slices, you're going to get 26.8 grams of protein. You do get close to 20 grams of fat, but most of that's coming from plant seeds. So it's
Susie, that's per 100 grams. For two slices.
Oh, I'm reading the wrong thing.
21.4 grams.
Oh, 21.4. Sorry, my mistake. Grams of protein. Thanks for correcting me. 16 grams of fat per serve, which would seem quite high, but it is coming a lot from the heavy grain base and seeds. Just 2.3 grams of saturated fat and just 3.6 grams of carbohydrate per two slices, which is incredibly low given that the average slice of even really healthy dense grain bread is going to have at least 20, if not up to 24 grams of carbohydrate per serve. So this is really slashing it down. And when we take a look at the ingredients, water, wheat, gluten, linseeds at 13%, sunflower seeds at 13%, explaining that high fat amount, bamboo fiber, canola oil, soy flour, vinegar, yeast, and iodized salt. So it's an interesting product and I think quite polarizing nutritionally. I will tell you what I think, but I would love first, Leanne, to hear what you think, because I think had you seen it before I sent it through?
Yeah. I've tried this one. I actually, my preference is probably either the Herman Brot one, which I know that a lot of the special IGA stock, or up here in Queensland anyway, or the Aldi lower carb, high protein bread as well. I actually find that it's more dense, but I find just the texture a bit nicer for me. I find this Woolworths one a bit chewy, for lack of a better word. Like, I feel like it looks more like quote unquote real bread, but I feel like just the texture of that, and I think it's down to the bamboo fiber that they put in there, which is the incredibly high fiber amount. I find like that for me, I'm a real texture person. So I actually prefer the texture in some of the other high protein loaves than this one. But on paper, this is a standout. As you said, this is a 5-star health rating. It is incredibly high in fiber, so high in fiber that some people with IBS might actually struggle with two slices of this. Carbohydrate for two slices is only 3.6 grams, which is, you know, insane. It's very, very low carbohydrate. So probably very appropriate for a ketogenic diet if that's something that you need to or want to follow. And in terms of the protein, 21 grams of protein. So if you're following a vegan or vegetarian based diet and you're not getting in a lot of protein, this is a perfect option. Or I say to I have some clients, Susie, who just want jam on toast, or they just want peanut butter on toast. And I say to them, you can't just have that with like a normal slice of bread, because jam on toast is like carbs on carbs. There's no protein, there's no fiber, there's nothing satiating in that breakfast option to actually keep you full for longer than about an hour. So this would be the perfect option. If you're someone who loves just spreads on toast, this is a wonderful option for that. And again, somebody who may have diabetes, or somebody who may have some chronic health conditions, or even those people who are constantly hungry, like they're hungry all the time, you want options that are high protein, high fiber. And this bread absolutely ticks the boxes. I can definitely get it down, but I wouldn't say that it is my preference out of the other higher protein loaves and lower carb loaves on the market. What do you think about it?
I find it a really interesting product. I should also say they've got bread rolls, which are really actually quite handy as a breakfast on the run. The issue I have with it, and you're right, if someone is specifically looking for a low carbohydrate diet, I think the protein is high, so you would need to watch the calories. It's not always conducive to keto. It would require some serious manipulation of those macros to get that right, given the protein's quite high. I use it as you do. So when I've got a client who wants jam, or I often do peanut butter and banana on this bread, and then I've got the perfect mix of, say, even if it's one slice, protein, a little bit of carbohydrate and good fat. Mm-hmm. But for my clients who in the morning I actually want to have some carbohydrates, the issue I have is that it can almost be starving them of that carbohydrate, because 4 grams per 2 slices is really low and is often too low for my clients who want to lean up or who are exercising in the morning. So I do use it, but I always, like you, give clients the choice of whether they prefer the Aldi or the Herman Brothers to this one. This one can be a little bit easier to find in sort of mainstream supermarkets, whereas if you're in more obscure regional places, it's not as easy to track down. I guess that the only thing that springs to mind with the Aldi brand is it does have a heavier soy base. And so that can be an issue for some people who are avoiding soy or more mindful of that. So like anything, it does have a place. It's not my first go-to. Generally, when I'm looking for a bread, I'm wanting a grainy, fibrous bread that has some carbohydrate. But it's definitely a product I use. And as I said, for those who are counting carbohydrates or like a plain toast in the morning, it can be a way I can get avocado on toast in and still get the protein load I'm looking for. So yeah, it's something that I think has a place, but it's not for everyone in the sense that more often than not, people will need a source of carbohydrate in the morning. So you might need to add some banana or some jam, as you said, to it to get a little bit of fuel to keep you going through the morning.
Definitely, yeah. Not something that we'd be giving our ladies who are doing that early morning high-intensity workout, because you definitely need carbs to replenish your energy stores, and definitely not something we would recommend for our kids. Our kids absolutely need carbohydrates at every meal. So this is really an adult-only product that we would recommend for specific people. And bearing in mind that for celiacs, it's not appropriate. It does contain wheat gluten, and it also contains soy. So if you have an allergen to soy, that's out for you as well. And it is processed in a factory that also contains sesame seeds. So if you're someone with a sesame seed allergy, unfortunately, the Woolworths Macro Linseed Low Carb Loaf is out. And it is a little bit pricey as well, Susie, when you think about it. You know, you can get a home brand multi-grand loaf for what, maybe $1.50, $2 or something. So this is $5 a loaf, and it is a lot smaller than the average loaf of bread as well. So that's something to bear in mind if you are on a bit of a stricter budget as well.
You can definitely freeze it. They freeze quite well to try and keep the seeds as fresh as possible. The other group that I use it with actually is my vegan clients who are trying to get a source of protein in their diet. But one issue I've had is that some of my vegan clients are a little bit younger and they're busy. They often rely on this as a meal on the go because they can quickly get protein, but their fat very quickly goes up because they're teaming it with avocado or nut spread. All of a sudden they're having 20, 30 grams of fat per serve. And for a small female, that adds up really quickly when they may only need 60 grams of fat total per day. So be mindful, it is absolutely good fat, but it is calorie dense and we can have too much of it. So as a general rule, I wouldn't recommend having more than a couple of slices per day, because you're getting those good fats from the seeds. You don't need to then double up on extra nuts and extra spreads, because you'll very quickly get up there with your overall fat intake. And that is another factor that can delay fat metabolism if you're over consuming for the amount of activity and how tall you are.
But I think overall, quite a good product for the specific type of person, put it that way.
And I think it's a massive growth area in the supermarkets. I think we will continue to see more and more of these products. And as a rule of thumb, Leanne, the less processed and the cleaner the ingredient list, where you're very aware of everything that's going in, is a good sign you're on the right track. Because like with all things, that the less processing and the more whole foods that you're consuming in it or in your bread, or the more seeds, the greater the proportion of grains, the better it will be nutritionally.
Absolutely. And this is actually quite a good whole food ingredient list as well. We recognize all of them. There's no artificial flavors, colors, enhancers, preservatives, that sort of thing. So it's actually pretty good in terms of ingredients too.
And contrary to popular belief, it doesn't have sugar added, because that's another very common question. Isn't there sugar added to the bread or to the white bread? And the answer is no. So that's good. Take a look at that ingredient list and it is relatively clean.
Definitely. And that brings us to our last segment for the day, Susie. To wrap us up, we're doing a listener question. So one that came in via our Instagram account this week, so the Nutrition Couch podcast on Instagram. And I honestly think this one comes up so much on social media, it's crazy. Is coconut oil really healthier, Susie? And does it help with weight loss, or does it burn fat like you see promoted all over social media. Coconut oil burns fat. You know, I've seen it. Put it in your hair, put it on your skin, rub it on your belly, whatever it is, ingest it, put it in your smoothie. Is it all it's cracked up to be?
Oh, Leanne, I'm not a coconut oil fan. And I would argue with, again, our scientific training, you'd be hard-pressed to find many dietitians who are. The reason, and I don't want to speak for you either, but the reason I don't like it is that when I'm looking to bring an oil into the diets of my clients, I'm looking for something that adds some positive nutrients, it adds good fats, it adds antioxidants. And when we take a look at the nutritional profile of coconut oil, it's 80 to 90% saturated fat with no antioxidants, no vitamin E. So to me, I look at it and see lard and I don't use it, I don't recommend it, and I've never bought it. I've never cooked with it because I don't see any positive health benefits associated with it. And I think the interest in coconut oil really grew about 5-7 years ago in line with the interest in keto and paleo diets, where people were looking to add that kind of fat back in, and there was a belief that saturated fats were good for us. And because coconut oil had a proportion of medium chain triglycerides, which is a type of fat metabolized in the liver, that this was a better option for fat metabolism. And I want to be very clear to say there's no evidence to show that that is the case. It's still a dense fat. And as a rule of thumb, the less added fat we have for most of us, because we enjoy our treats too much, we don't need it. And it's not a product you'll ever see me use, recommend, or cook with myself. So I'm pretty definite I'm not a fan, and I would much prefer extra virgin olive oil. It's the only oil I cook with myself, I recommend, because there are proven health benefits associated with it.
And I think where a lot of the confusion with saturated fat, and I remember years ago, it was a front cover of Times magazine. Time. It said the fat is back, didn't it? And it just exploded from there. And I remember seeing something about, you know, saturated fat isn't that bad. And I think that was in line with a lot of the research around dairy that actually showed that full cream dairy was not as bad as what we originally had thought, you know, as nutritionists and dietitians. Saturated fat in dairy is now what we would consider, or what I would consider, a neutral fat. It's actually not really, the saturated fat isn't positive to our health, but it's more neutral. It's not negative. It's not going to block up our arteries like we originally thought, like some of the other types of saturated fat. And I think where coconut oil has got caught up in a lot of this is that, as you mentioned, a lot of the claims, the health claims relating to coconut oil, are actually more related to the fact that a lot of people think that coconut oil is an MCT, a medium chain triglyceride, but it's not, because the majority of coconut oils on the market are actually, they behave more like long chain fatty acids. The predominant fat in coconut oil is actually lauric acid, and lauric acid is not and does not behave like an MCT. So I think that's the biggest misconception out there, is that people just say that coconut oil is an MCT, it's metabolized really easily, it'll help you burn fat really easily. And that's simply not the case. If you actually look right down to the science and actually look at the bonded, you know, carbons and that sort of thing in it, it actually behaves more like a long chain fatty acid than it does a medium chain fatty acid. So from a metabolic standpoint, it is not a medium chain triglyceride. And so I think that that's where a lot of the misinformation on social media around coconut oil comes from. So I'm like you, I'm not really a fan. I will occasionally use it for flavor, like if I'm making a curry or if I'm making some sort of raw dessert that needs to set, because coconut oil is a solid at room temperature. So if I'm making something that I really want to set, like a slice or something like that, I might use a little bit of coconut oil. But honestly, I think I've had the same bottle in my pantry for well over a year now, because 98% of the time, extra virgin olive oil is my top pick, because we know it's backed by research and science. We know it's positively geared towards our health. We know it's packed full of health benefits. We have the research and the science to prove that. Whereas unfortunately with coconut oil, unless you're using it from a taste perspective, there's really not much else in there that is helpful. I do know that for new mums, you can rub it on your nipples. It really helps with cracked nipples with breastfeeding, so my best friends tell me. And also you can put it through your hair. Apparently it helps, you know, make your hair a little bit shinier. They're really the only two health benefits I find from coconut oil. So breastfeeding mums, buy some coconut oil. It will really be helpful for you. And of course it's natural, so babies can eat it and you can breastfeed with it, of course. And also you can put it in your hair or you can rub it onto dry skin. But actually, ingesting it in terms of a health benefit, I haven't seen anything, Susie. There's nothing really in the research that shows us that it's actually beneficial or more beneficial than some of our other oils, which unfortunately it is promoted a lot of the time as more beneficial. So that's the nutrition stance on the Nutrition Counts podcast. We are pro extra virgin olive oil, very neutral when it comes to coconut oil, or even more on that negative side, Susie.
100%. So I'm sure we'll have some feedback on that. So we look forward to it. So that brings us to the end of the Nutrition Couch for another week. If you haven't done so already, we would love you to subscribe and have us delivered to your inbox every Sunday morning so you can set yourself up for a healthy week ahead. And we would be so grateful if you could leave us a review in the Purple Apple Podcast app. We have our Instagram and Facebook social sites running, so feel free to send us any feedback or questions. And we are at the Nutrition Couch Podcast, and we're going to see you the same time, same place next Sunday. Thanks for listening.
See you guys next week.